Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street, where brunch is being served. Today's guest is Dr. Charles Benbrook, who is a research professor at the Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources at Washington State University. He is the program leader of Measure to Manage Farm and Food Diagnostics for Sustainability and Health. His career has focused on developing science-based systems for evaluating the public health, environmental, and economic impacts of changes in agricultural systems, biotechnology, and policy. He has worked extensively on pesticide use and risk assessment and the development of biointensive integrated pest management. He played an important role in the evolution of the 1996 Food Quality Protection Act and has produced multiple reports on agricultural biotechnology. In other words, he is the Mac Daddy of biotech and ag. Welcome to the program, Chuck Benson. Benbrook, thank you so much for joining me today on Sunday. I really appreciate your time. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Katie.
Dr. Benbrook, if I may call you that, or should I call you Chuck?
Let's try Chuck.
Okay, Chuck is good. Chuck, before we jump into the nitty-gritty of this stuff, can you just define GMO, genetically modified organisms, and how this technology is different from hybridization, which, you know, everybody thinks, I think a lot of people have a misapprehension that genetically modified organisms and hybridization are kind of one and the same thing, but they're really very different. So can you explain what that difference is?
Sure. A genetically modified organism, also referred to as a genetically engineered organism,
right,
has moved into its genome, so into its genes, a genetic trait from outside of that particular organism. So in other words, if you take a fish gene and move it into a tomato, mm-hmm. you create a genetically engineered tomato with a novel trait that is brought about by the DNA, you know, from the fish. So that is the essential characteristic of a so-called GMO plant.
And that's opposed to hybridization, where you just crossbreed different strains of the same genetic package, correct?
Exactly. All of your there's a wide range of traditional plant breeding techniques that involve taking advantage of the genetic diversity that exists within the tomato genome or within the corn or wheat genomes. These methods, however, do not introduce any DNA from outside of the tomato, corn, or wheat genomes.
Okay, cool. All right, I think that clears up that, in case everybody was wondering exactly what the difference is. There you have it, straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. Now, to go right into the GMO issue, the industry argument, and by this I mean large-scale agriculture argument, is that we need GMO crops to provide enough food for the growing world population. How accurate do you think that argument is?
Oh, it's not terribly accurate. None of the existing genetically engineered crops on the market today, were developed to increase yields. The primary traits that are in the market relate to pest management. The biggest one, of course, are the so-called herbicide-tolerant crops. Mm-hmm. And these would include corn, soybeans, cotton, canola, sugar beets, alfalfa, and a few others. These crops are genetically engineered to withstand applications of a broad-spectrum herbicide called glyphosate, or commonly referred to as Roundup. So this largest group of GE crops that have been planted around the world since 1996, they really don't have anything to do with increasing yields. In fact, the evidence suggests a small yield drag as a result of the genetic transformation that renders them tolerant of applications of this Roundup herbicide, which without the genetic transformation, a farmer spraying this herbicide on a soybean field, for example, would kill both the soybeans and the weeds, and, right. and that obviously is not something farmers want to do.
So initially they were thinking that this was going to reduce the pesticide and herbicide load on agricultural land, and in fact, as you recently, in your recently published 16-year-long study on GMO crops, you described something quite different. Can you talk about what you found in your study?
Well, sure. There's two major types of GMO or genetic engineering traits that have been moved into corn, soybeans, and cotton. These are the big three crops that account mm-hmm. for, I'm sure, over 95% of the acres of GMO crops planted around the world in the last 16 years. The one type, as I said, are engineered to be herbicide tolerant, and these crops, of course, would impact herbicide use. And then the other major type are so-called BT transgenic or insect protected crops, and there are only two major crops that have this trait: corn and cotton. And these GE crops are engineered to manufacture within all the cells of the plant a natural bioinsecticide that is derived from a soil bacterium. So for those crops, they've been genetically altered to produce inside of them a natural insecticide, making it unnecessary for farmers to spray certain insecticides during the season. So the BT transgenic crops impact insecticide use, and the so-called herbicide-tolerant crops impact herbicide use. And what my study found over the first 16 years of commercial planting of these major GE crop technologies in the United States, there's been over a 500 million pound increase in herbicide use, above which it likely would have been in the absence of this technology, and about 125 million pound decrease in insecticide use brought about by the so-called BT crops, resulting in overall, in terms of the impact of today's GE crops on pesticide use, about a 400 million pound increase over what pesticide use would likely have been in the absence of the technology. So, while the industry has claimed that these technologies were designed to reduce pesticide use, the BT insect protector traits have been delivering on that promise fairly consistently, although lesser in recent years. But the herbicide-tolerant crops have really backfired and triggered the emergence and spread of a number of weeds resistant to glyphosate, which has in turn forced farmers to increase their applications of herbicides.
You know, I think that's just, you know, if I were a farmer, I'd be really mad because, first of all, doesn't it cost more? Excuse me. Doesn't it cost more for farmers to buy the extra herbicides? So if you've bought, if you've invested in your Monsanto or your whatever other companies are producing these, if you've invested in that technology and you're finding that you're ending up, which probably costs you more to start with, am I right in that? Can you comment
on
that?
Yeah, the big economic hit on farmers is when they buy the seed.
Right.
The genetically engineered seed in the case of corn is about four times more expensive than conventional seed. It's between three and four times more expensive in the case of genetically engineered soybeans. And in the case of cotton, it's six times more expensive. Mm-hmm. So the biotech companies have been able to have very strong intellectual property protection or patent protection on the genetically engineered crop variety. So that's where they charge their premium prices, as opposed to making money off increased herbicide sales, which they certainly do. But the real profit center for the biotech companies is the seed.
So it lies within the seed, and yet, so you pay all this extra money to get your herbicide protected crop, and instead you find yourself buying X number of extra herbicides in order to, it's sort of like using antibiotics in multiples. You're using herbicides in multiples. Am I right about that?
Yeah, and not only are many farmers having to spray more often and spray additional herbicides, but even with extra applications of herbicides, they still have control failures in their fields and problems in harvesting their crop the virtual certainty of even a bigger problem in the next crop season.
Mike, another question to ask you. I'm going to go on to superweeds in just a second, but I want to go back to what you said about the insecticides. Sorry about that. Why do you think the insecticides have been more powerful, and do you not fear that they will generate in turn a super bug, a super insect that is also resistant to those genetically engineered crops, the BT corn, for example?
Good question, Katie. Well, actually, when the BT corn and cotton applications came into the government, and in the case of these insect protected crops, these are actually regulated under our federal pesticide statute by the EPA. Mm-hmm. The EPA, in effect, interprets a BT expressing genetically engineered corn variety as a, they call it a plant pesticide.
Wow.
It's a plant that produces pesticides, so they're actually regulating it under the authorities granted to the agency in the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. And what the EPA did in the case of the BT crops that they didn't do in the case of the herbicide-tolerant crops was require from the get-go, from the very first approval, that farmers had to abide by a number of specific practices recommended by university scientists and industry specialists to prevent the emergence of resistant insects, so-called superbugs, to use the popular terminology. And these provisions that were a mandatory part of the federal approval that went on to the bags of BT corn and the bags of BT cotton and bound farmers to certain practices have proven, for the most part, effective in delaying the emergence of resistance. We do see, unfortunately, just in the last couple of years, the first signs of truly resistant insect populations that have been created by the heavy reliance on these BT crops. So the success over the last 15, 16 years in reducing insecticide use through the planting of these crops is now also in jeopardy because of the spread of resistant insects. And right now, if you, for example, go on to the website of of any of the major land-grant universities in corn country or mm-hmm. down in the south where BT cotton is grown, you'll see academic insect specialists recommending to farmers to both plant the genetically engineered seeds and spray insecticides in order to try to prevent or delay the spread of these resistant insects. So it's kind of like the whole purpose of the technology in the first place was to make it unnecessary to spray certain insecticides, and now, ironically, the farmers are being advised to both pay the extra for the seeds plus still spray the insecticide. So we're kind of back to square one.
Back to square one. And what amazes me is that with all of the information and findings about the evolution of insects and weeds or plants, the fact that they, you know, that they evolve at such a greater rate than, say, humans, why couldn't they anticipate this? I mean, I find it incredible that this was completely unanticipated. What do you think about that?
Oh, you are flat wrong, Katie. It was totally anticipated and predicted by a number of scientists. In fact, a very wise entomologist from Texas A&M University, a guy named Marvin Harris, predicted the number of generations in the European corn borer and certain cotton insects, the number of generations that it would take, and hence the number of years, for resistance to show up to in BT cotton. And he was right. He was actually exactly right. I think his original estimate was 15 to 17 generations, and there's like four per year. So, you know, his estimate was, you know, 5 or 6 years of BT cotton before you'll see the first signs of resistance. And that's pretty much what
right
happened.
On the money.
And the same thing goes with the herbicides. I mean, the herbicide tolerant crops are custom made to trigger the emergence of resistant weeds and the spread of resistant weeds, especially if farmers heavily rely on a single herbicide-tolerant technology and a single herbicide, which is exactly what happened because of the domination of the GE crop market by the so-called Roundup Ready herbicide-tolerant varieties. You know, we've got In the United States, just in ballpark figures, farmers harvest a bit over 300 million acres of cropland every year, and over half of it is planted to crops that carry this Roundup Ready gene. So you can imagine this intense selection pressure across the surface area of the United States. Wherever weeds grow, with farmers' fields being sprayed over and over again every year with glyphosate herbicide, it was going to trigger resistant weeds, and it has. There are now in the United States 23 different weed species that are resistant to glyphosate, and some recent industry surveys suggest that as many as 100 million acres, so about two-thirds of the acres planted to these herbicide-tolerant varieties, already have one or more herbicide-resistant weed on them.
Wow, that's a stunning stunning set of statistics. And so just to ask the obvious question, what impact do these superweeds and the rise in chemical use, the crops, et cetera, have on the environment? Like, for instance, I'm thinking about bees. I'm thinking about water pollution, farm workers' health, et cetera, et cetera. Like, can you give us like a quick thumbnail of that?
Well, sure. You know, in the case of the BT crops, their relative success in managing some of the hardest to control insects in both corn and cotton, they have reduced the need for farmers to spray some pretty nasty broad spectrum insecticides that harm a lot of beneficial insects, pose risk to farm workers and bees and birds. So there's been some documented improvement in some of the corn and cotton production areas in terms of lessened use of higher risk insecticides, although that benefit is starting to be eroded now by the emergence of some resistant insects. In the case of herbicides, it's a much different story. The commercial introduction of the herbicide-tolerant crops, and in particular the Roundup Ready crops, was heralded by farmers. It was a very simple system. It worked really well. While it cost farmers a bit more, it was worth it to the farmers because Roundup Ready technology turned one of the farmers' biggest headaches, weed management, into one of the simplest aspects of managing their corn, soybean, and cotton crops. So they really liked it, even though they had to spray more herbicides by volume, even though they had to spend a bit more money. But and so that's why the technology was adopted so rapidly.
Sure.
But after 5 or 6 years of use, and the resistant weeds started to emerge, farmers found that to get the same level of control, they had to spray 10% more, 15% more glyphosate each year, and then they had to add another herbicide into the mix, and then a few years later they'd have to add a second additional herbicide into the mix. And so as this ramping up of herbicide use has now gone on for almost a decade.
It
really started around 2000-2001 with the emergence of the first resistant weeds, and now, you know, we've crop year 2012, which was a total disaster for American farmers because of the drought.
Right.
I mean, the problems with superweeds was not very prominent in farm country this summer because of the devastating drought, and for obvious reasons. But, you know, the concern is, you know, what's going to happen next year. And so the in terms of the environment and public health, many people are deeply concerned about the likelihood that the U.S. Department of Agriculture will approve soon a next generation of multiple herbicide-tolerant crops that have been genetically engineered to withstand glyphosate and another herbicide, glufosinate or Liberty, as well as a old phenoxy herbicide called 2,4-D, which is one of the higher risk herbicides that are on the market today. It's been around since the 50s. This 2,4-D was about 50%, made up about 50% of the herbicide used in Vietnam called Agent Orange. Which,
oh my God!
Remember the
military made me lose my headphones, man.
Sprayed it out of B-52 bombers to and helicopters to defoliate the forest to make it easier to fight the
Viet Cong
gorillas.
Yeah, so, of course.
You know, the industry was very proud of the fact that glyphosate was generally regarded, and I would agree, that as one of the safer herbicides on the market at the time. 2,4-D is definitely one of the riskier ones. And research done by the federal government, paid for by our tax dollars, in the late 80s and early 90s, proved that 2,4-D herbicide applications increase a number of reproductive problems, including spontaneous abortions and failure to conceive, increase a number of different birth defects, and also at least 4 different types of cancers.
Oh my God!
So this is, in the next few years, this is what farmers and their rural neighbors in the Midwest and in cotton and soybean country in the Southeast. This, unfortunately, is what they have to look forward to. Millions of more pounds of riskier herbicides being sprayed all through the summer period, when people are outside, people are growing their gardens. There'll be substantial new exposure pathways that we have no experience with.
Right.
By virtue of the use of this next generation of herbicide-tolerant crops.
Well, we have to take a short break, unfortunately, but we're going to come right back to that very same aspect in just a second. Please stay with us. My guest is Dr. Charles Benbrook from Washington State University, talking about GMO crops. This is Straight No Chaser, and we'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com.
And we're back with Dr. Charles Benbrook. My name is Katie Kiefer. This show is called Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. Dr. Benbrook, we were just talking a second ago about, what did you call it, 2,4-D?
Yes.
Yes. And 2,4-D is an agent that is used as an herbicide. It's been around since the 50s. Thank you. It reminds me of like thalidomide babies. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of technology, doesn't it? I mean, it's that so sort of like these fabulous chemicals that were supposed to do these wonderful things. And then, you know, the next thing you know, you're delivering an infant with no arms. But anyway, so now we're delivering crops that have been sprayed with something that we used that Vietnam veterans came back, you know, in droves, with terrible issues because of their exposure to Agent Orange. And here we are planning to drop more of it onto our own agricultural fields. So, and that leads me, and you were saying that it causes spontaneous abortion, fertility issues. And it reminds me of a recent French study that I read about earlier this season that demonstrated alarming results from feeding rats with GMO corn with and without glyphosate, which was thoroughly criticized by a number of scientists and quickly dismissed as flawed. You're aware of that study, right?
Oh, sure, the Seralini study. Yes,
exactly. Did you think it was flawed? And I think it's interesting that that study mimics what you just described as the effects of using 2,4-D.
Well, you know, there's a very lively debate going on in the scientific community about this study by a French, very experienced French toxicologist. Named Seralini, and there was a half dozen other scientists on the team that carried out this work. It is indisputable, actually, that the Seralini study is the most sophisticated and sensitive study of its kind ever carried out, and it actually Seralini and his colleagues set out to replicate, but do an even better job, a more careful job of testing the impacts of a particular GE corn event with and without glyphosate herbicide in a study design that mimicked the original 2004 study developed and paid for by Monsanto that mm-hmm. supported the original regulatory review and approvals of this technology. So what Seralini did is they looked at the Hammond et al. 2004 study and assessed where it was the limitations of it compared to, you know, contemporary testing guidelines.
Right.
I mean, for example, the old 2004 study only fed the rats for 90 days.
Right.
Well, that's like you know, a 90-day-old rat is like an adolescent in human years. And we know that most cancers in humans don't show up in the teenage years. Most cancers that, you know, have a latency period in humans of 20 or more years. So clearly there was concern that this original Hammond study might be missing some longer-term subtle health effects because it only covered 90 days of the life of the rat. So Seralini and his group designed their study very much like Hammond, but fed the rats for 2 years.
Right.
And to their amazement, they didn't expect to find this, but they had a statistically significant increase in a number of tumors, in cancer tumors, in the rats that started to appear in the second year. And this was one of the explosive findings that got a lot of media attention. The team actually circulated some photos of rats with these, you know, ugly large tumors, And this got a lot of attention, but it also triggered a lot of criticism because Seralini didn't design the study from the beginning as a cancer study, which would have required 50 animals per control and dosage group. That's what the OECD, which is an international body, that's what their testing guidelines call for in a study that is originally designed to test for cancer. Seralini's study was just a long-term feeding study that only had 20 animals per group. Uh-huh. But nonetheless, they did observe this statistically significant increase in tumors, and they reported that. And this is one of the reasons that the study has been so soundly criticized. But for all the you know, any readers that are actually interested in what was found and the debate in the scientific community, there's a lengthy set of letters on the website.
Yes.
Of the journal, including the Seralini's team response to the criticisms that have been received to date on the website. Perhaps on your show's website, you can put a link
The
letters on the journal's website. I actually just read all of them. And, you know, I think Seralini and his team are doing a pretty good job responding to the criticism, although, you know, they certainly have an awful lot of critics out there.
They do. I mean, I was amazed at the pushback. And that leads me to my next question, because unfortunately we're going to have to wrap it up. I hope you'll come back, because this is just way too much information for a 1.5-hour show. But what about your study? Did you get a lot of pushback from say Monsanto and its contemporaries in terms of your findings on the 16-year pattern of herbicide use?
Well, not so much from Monsanto itself. I mean, Monsanto is a very sophisticated company, and they know that if they criticize or attack a scientist like Seralini or myself, that is going to trigger a response in the media that probably isn't in their best interest. So
yeah, right.
What Monsanto does is they fund various surrogates, other university professors, trade associations like the Biotechnology Industry Organization, or BIO,
sure.
Various other academic groups to conduct reviews and really offer up the criticism of work like that done by Seralini and myself. I've been analyzing the impact of GE crops on pesticide use in the United States for 10 years, and my findings have become clearer and stronger as the years have gone by. And, you know, I'm just trying to keep the industry honest. You know,
yes.
You will still find claims by so-called experts that today's GE crops are reducing pesticide use. It's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not true. And so I hope, if anything, my work will bring some discipline into the PR from the biotech industry to at least be honest with the fact that, yeah, the herbicide-tolerant crops worked really well for the first, you know, 5, even 8 years, but they're not working as well now, and herbicide use has gone up. You know, that's part of the story. It's not the full story, but it's an important part, and it's one that I'm trying to keep the biotech industry honest on.
Well, we're going to have you come back to talk more about just that issue. And the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, but unfortunately we don't have time to today, is about the competition for funding and corporate pressures, which I do think have a significant impact on what studies get funded and what don't, and ultimately have a kind of somewhat corrupting influence on the scientific community in that sense. So I want you to think about that. And we'll schedule another program to talk really just about that, just about how studies are funded. And would you be willing to do that?
Sure. It's a very important topic.
It
and,
is.
I'll take my homework assignment seriously.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much for joining me today. Again, my guest today was Dr. Charles Benbrook from, is it Washington State University, sir?
Yep, Washington State University out in the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much again for joining us. And thank you to my sponsor, Sam Edwards and S. Wallace Edwards & Son. And congratulations to Sam for winning yet another award for his amazing Suriano ham. Next week, my friends, we will be joined by Amanda Hitt from the Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C. She's going to come on to talk about chickens and the new proposed rules about chicken inspection, which should have you all trembling in your boots and definitely buying from your local farmers. So this has been another fabulous episode. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Thanks to my engineer, Joe Galarraga. And we'll see you next week with Amanda Hitt. So long for now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.